Okay. When last we met before the great snowstorm of Tavshin Ayin Daled, we were in the middle of discussing the question of the nature of machlokes between Ashkenazim and Sephardim. Just to sum up the last points that we made, that number one, that the position of the Gaonim, the position of Chachmei Tzfon Africa and of Spain, was that that there was really just proper halakhic answer, which we try to ascertain, that the Rambam says as a result that machlokes is a bad thing. You know, joke about the fact that minigas have machlokes. Do you know the joke? Okay, good. I'm not going to waste time with the joke then. That in fact the machlokes is a problem. In the Rambam, I showed you number three, in the Hakdamat of the Perush of the Mishnah, points out that in fact he makes an effort to note that there is a minimal number of authentic or important or central machlokot in Shas, and number two, that in general machloket is a sign of intellectual decline, and the more that we can in fact reduce machloket, the more that we can try to ascertain the one unified and unitary halachic truth, the better off we are. I don't remember if we mentioned. I was going to actually check this out and listen to the shiur before today, but I didn't double check. That is the reason, one of the reasons, why overwhelmingly poskim, in other words, not every, you have to poskim shilas all the time, but the reason why the massive sifrei apsak that cover all of halacha were consistently authored by Sfaradim. Whether it's the Rif, well, first of all, the Gaonim, but whether it's the Rif, whether it's the Rambam, whether it's the Tur, who for our purposes, even though he's an Ashkenazi, lives in Toledo, works in Toledo, is primarily Sephardi. The same thing, Rabbi Yosef Karo. The more there is, the more variations there are, the worse there is. If you take a look at, this is what the, for example, Rabbi Yosef Karo writes in the introduction to the Beit Yosef, Baruch Hashem, number four, Baruch Hashem Elokei Yisrael, Hashem bara olamo l'tachlit ha'adam, u'mikol min ha'adam b'chalo am skula, and so on and so forth. And he writes that this is terrible. We're in the middle of all kinds of expulsions and upheavals, and as a result, the last line after the three dots, lo na'aseta Torah kibet Torot, k'shtei Torot ele k'torot ein mispar, v'sibot rov ha'sparim ha'nimtzaim b'biur mishpatei ha'vedineha. In other words, the more books, the more opinions, the worse off we are. There has to be one Torah, because there's only one Emet, and there's the Kael Emet, Natan Lanu Torah Emet, Vatoi Dektivba Emet, Ein Lanu Kihimim La Emet, Einenu, which is something actually that Reb Chaim Volozhiner writes at the end of Siman Yud Aleph in Chutah Meshulash from a totally different point of view. Truth is indivisible, therefore there can only be one truth. And that's what the Posek strives for when he sits down to Paskin. All right, he might be right, it might be wrong. And the reason, but nevertheless, he strived for the truth. And therefore, when we say Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, it doesn't mean that everybody, you know, you're right, you're right, you're right. But rather, both opinions have been developed based on the established methodologies of Torah Shebal Peh and of Psak Halacha. They are therefore legitimate, credible, and valid. But Klape Shmaya Galya, this is only one of them is correct. Okay, so that is fundamentally the fundamental stance of at least up until the Ashkenazi invasion of Spain in the late 12th, early 13th century. That is the classic Sephardic position. There are tremendous ramifications for this position. Number one, they come into the first impact of this position is, number one, that when you sit down to learn Gemara, your function is lasuke shmatata aliba dehilchta. You sit down, you learn Gemara, why? To know what the psak is. This is a line which accompanies Sephardic postgame from the beginning until today. If you take a look, there's a lovely, aggressive proponent of the position. It was Rav Avad Yosef Zechatarik Livracha. He has some very sharp things to say about things that he says are wrong in the Ashkenazi yeshiva world, basically the stuff that we do in Beis Medrash every day. He says, too much pilpul and not enough asivkei mishmaita libe de'ilchasa. If you want to take a look at a very good presentation of a religious position, you can take a look at Rabbi Benny Lau's book, Mimaran Vaad Maran, in the first part of the book when he sort of characterizes Rabbi Rav Yosef's overall approach. He brings together some of the sharper statements on this on these grounds. Number one. Number two, as a result, the emphasis on learning Gemara for purposes of Psak Halacha has two more ramifications, one, at least two ramifications. One, which impacts on the way that the early medieval Sephardim write commentaries on the Gemara, and also in terms of the curriculum, the definition of what is legitimate, what do you spend your time with when you're Mekayim the Netzot Talmud Torah. Let's start with the commentaries on Shas. There are a number of commentaries that have reached us from the from the up to the high Middle Ages. Let me give you some chronology over here. Okay, Spain was conquered by the Muslims in 711. Okay, and the so-called Golden Age in Spain, there wasn't one, by the way, never existed. As far as, well, there were two halachas. Let's do it this way: there were two halachas in the Golden Age in Spain. Halacha number one never happened. So you can't say elu ba'elu. Halacha number two did happen. Halacha number one, during the 10th, 11th, and early 12th century, was the story that Arabs and Jews loved each other and there was equal rights and everybody got along, and it was what the apologists for Jewish Muslim interfaith dialogue say, convivencia, everybody loved each other. Not true, never happened. Couldn't happen, by definition can't happen. Zimi, kafiri, not infidels cannot by definition ever be on the same level as Muslims, so put that aside, that we can paskin against, that's shalok halacha. The other halacha in the Golden Age in Spain did happen, in the sense that the encounter with Muslim or with Arab culture did help to stimulate an amazing upsurge of Jewish creativity, which enriched Judaism for all time, whether in the field of literature, of language, of poetry, of halacha, of parshanut ha-mikra, you name it, philosophy, science, that's true. Has nothing to do with the Arabs. Had nothing to do with the Muslims whatsoever. Okay. In any event, this was from say 950 to 1148, when the so-called Golden Age in Spain was brought to an end by the invasion of Muslim fanatics from North Africa, who called the Almohadim. During that period of time, there was a tremendous upsurge also in a renaissance of Talmud Torah. And during that time, some very serious and very important works of Parshanut were written on the Gemara. Some of them were written by rabbis from North Africa, like the Rif, Rabbi Yitzchak, what's his second name? Al-Fasi means that he originally came from? Fez, correct. He originally came from Fez in North Africa, and towards the end of his life moved to Spain, to the city of Lucena, which still exists. Lucena is an interesting place. It was sort of like Borough Park in Andalusia. There's a wonderful tshuva of one of the Gaonim who, when they wrote from Lucena, they wrote to Baghdad and asked whether you can make an Erev in Baghdad. And the Gaon in question writes back, he said, absolutely no question, because there's not one guy who living in Lucena could make a problem in terms of being Oser on the other members of the Jews of Lucena. In any event, there are a number of the commentaries that are written, and to characterize them generally, for our purposes, I'm going to actually zero in on two commentaries that weren't written in Spain proper, but in North Africa, but it's the same kind of style, though, because there are two commentaries of which you're aware, that of Rabbeinu Hananel of Ben Chushiel of Cairo 1, and his later contemporary, Rabbeinu Nissim Gaon. I'm mentioning these because you probably are aware of these from the side of the Gemara. Rabbeinu Hananel lived in Cairo 1, which is a major cultural center in North Africa, with intense ties with Spain. Rabbeinu Hananel's commentary is the first commentary on Shas to cover most if not all of Shas. However, the way it's structured is that he provides, if you look, take a look when you have a chance, it doesn't really matter. It's a commentary which it was written before 1150. I wrote down the number because I get confused. He died in 1057. So he died when Rashi was a teenager. The commentary gives you some words, strange, and a little bit of background information. He zeroes in always on, in a long shot of Italia, he zooms in on the critical piece of the Gemara and ignores the rest. Either ignoring it because it's not, he doesn't think it's relevant, or ignoring it because he says Advarim Pshutim. Now, what does that mean, Advarim Pshutim? It means if he ignores a long sugi and only zeroes in on certain specific issues, and the same thing with Nissim Gaon is even more, Nissim Gaon is even more like that. What it means is that statement has two implications. Number one, he assumes that everybody who's going to use his perush must be living in a Torah center where they can get the background to understand all these things, which he assumes are pshutim. You follow? Right? Because otherwise, I mean, see, this isn't Schottenstein. All right? You can't learn the Gemara with the Rabbeinu Hanano like it's Schottenstein, because they didn't give you enough information. There's an assumption that this is for advanced students who are struggling through, but who have acquired a fundamentally strong background so they can function on their own, or they can actually go into the Beis Medrash and ask. That's number one. Number two, there's another possibility. In order to understand that possibility, it's actually a good idea to ask ourselves about the riff. How's the riff structured? Do you learn riff on a regular basis? You should. The boys in the back are important. So, how's the riff structured? What happens? You open the riff, and what do you have there? What? Right. So, what's the riff do? The riff gives you on any single issue, primarily. He gives you the Mishnah, and then if you have a central sugya, if you have a central machlokes, he'll give you both opinions. Then he'll give you the final. Now, before he gets to the psak, he'll give you the raya, which is machriya, which determines the which way you go in any machlokes. They give you a psak. Okay. What happens if it's 45 back and forth before? I mean, you can start with a Vayev Rav, you can go on for 3-4 dots. Okay? All that stuff in the middle is gone. It takes it out. Why? It's Shaloka Halacha, number one. Correct. Excellent. The other reason is, the assumption is, these extra stages are called what? There's a word for those. They're called Okimtas. Okay? Maybe I can bring a Raya from here. It looks like it's a good Raya for a Bayez, say, for example. And Rav says, no, you can interpret it that way. All right, that means you can't be a raya from this case. Therefore, the raya is irrelevant. It is. I don't want to say wrong, but it's not. It doesn't play a it doesn't play a constructive role in the search for the final psak, and therefore it can be dismissed. All right. Therefore, you don't need to spend time with it, because your focus is on what? Halacha. In other words, darshaning out and interpreting the various stages of a long, drawn-out debate between Abaye and Rava do not play a central role in the process of Talmud Torah in terms of Gemara as far as this school is concerned, because it's wrong. This Raya doesn't work. It doesn't work. If it can work both for Abaye and Rava, it doesn't work in this context. You follow? Okay. So as a result, now you understand why Rabbeinu Hananel, the riff by implication, will only zero in on that raya, which is the one, which is the winning one, the one that determines it. Okay, by Rav is not, you don't have to break your head over that. But if you know, whatever the case might be, the one that clinches the argument, that's the important one, and that's the one we're going to focus in. That's the one Rabbeinu Hananel focuses on. That's the one Rabbeinu Nissim quotes, and that's the one the riff cites before he gives the final psak. Because it's that specific orientation in terms of what Lern and Gemara is about. There's another implication for that. One of the things that Murray Farabi of Soloveitchik, Zechel Tzadik Livracha, spent the last 50 years of his life, the last 40 years of his, let's say, of his not 40 years, 30 years, last 30 years of his career, emphasizing in his public drushes is the fact that it's not sufficient to just cultivate learning and shmiras hamitzvahs without developing your soul. In other words, ruchnius, even in Talmud Torah, is a critical element of Yiddishkeit. Agada and halacha have to go together. They can't exist separately. Halacha without agadata, here this is my formulation. Halacha without agadata, without ruchnius, it becomes fossilized, and ruchnius without agadata becomes totally anarchic. The two have to go together. And as Professor Twersky, my teacher, pointed out through most of his writings, the question of how do you achieve both is one of the things which preoccupied Gedolei Yisrael through the ages. One of the questions that is involved in developing one's ruchnius and one's relationship with the Kaddish Baruch Hu is, in fact, the question of what do you study? Because we don't just go, we're not a bunch of Hindus or Buddhists and sit in the lotus position and go with a mantra, go mm. Even when we develop our neshamas, we also study. The question is, what do you study? So I'm going to already give away the Ashkenazi answer. The Ashkenazi answer from the time the Balei Tosfos on has generally been, if you know how to learn Gemara properly, it is an act of Matan Torah, it is an act of standing before our Kodesh Baruch Hu, and as a result, learning Gemara is all you need. We'll come back to that. Among Sephardim, at least up until, well, no, actually, it's a major theme in Sephardic writings all the way down to today. That's not precisely correct. If you take a look at number 5, this is a famous statement by the Chovas HaLevavos, Rabbi Bakeh ibn Pagoda. Rabbi Bakeh ibn Pagoda is interesting. He's known as a Baal Musar. He wasn't just a Baal Musar. The Chovas HaLevavos is in fact a book of ethics. It's also a book of philosophy. The problem is in yeshivas, until relatively recently, and in the black yeshivas it's still true, they skipped those parts of the book which are philosophically oriented, so you wouldn't know that he was involved in philosophy. But what's interesting as well, he was a follower of Reb Sadia Gaon's Emunot V'Dayot. But the interesting part of it was, he wasn't, you know, usually you say, oh, the philosophers in the Middle Ages, they were doctors, and they were this, and they were that. No chokhmas. Rabbi Bakeh ibn Pagoda was a dayan. He sat in Saragossa, and he did gittin, and he paskin shilas, and he paskin chickens, and whatever. But he's a person profoundly involved in using rationalism and philosophy as a way to search for God. And here in the introduction to this, to the Chovas HaLevavos, he tells the following story, number 5. You're going to see that the enumeration here is very. I didn't fix it, so just you'll excuse me. The nishal echad min hachachamim al she'elad nachurit minyan din hagerushin. Some kid comes into the Beis Medrash, and he asks him this bizarre question. I don't know. You stand on the chair, and you made the get into a paper airplane, and went around like this, and it went this way and that way, and maybe they were too late, and maybe they were. You can figure out what kind of weird hechitim they might have come up with. The Shiva Cholos, he comes in and asks the Rav, what do you think about this? So this Dayan, we don't know if this is actually Rabbi Nebachia or not, but since he was heavily involved in Gittin, I always suspected that it was him. Ataha ishoel al mashalo yizikenu. You're asking a hechitim, so it's not going to hurt you not to know it. Im lo yedaenu. Hayadata kol masha tachayav ladat min hamitzvot asher incha rashai litalem mehem vein ra'ui lecha lefshoa bahem ad shenifneta lachshoa b'sheilot nochriot asher lo tikne b'yidiatan ma'ala yeteira b'toratcha u'b'munatcha v'lo titaken ba me'uvat b'midot nafshecha. He says, is this going to help you in your ruchnias? Is this going to help you in the neshama? Is this going to make you a better person? Are you going to learn how to have a good midos? Do you come closer to Kaddish Baruch Hu as a result of this? Is your faith any stronger? Whether on the question of whether this get becomes whether you make the get into a paper airplane that looks like a 747, a 777, or that's also kind of brandy, right? 777, or whatever the case might be. No, what are you trying around that you're talking about this? He says, "Hine ani nishba ki chameshu shoshim shana ani mitasek b'mesh tzarich li mitzvot torati." But I yodea rov tarchi b'iyun v'rov asfarim etzli. I'm not a small London. I've got a big library. I've learned a lot. V'lo paniti libi l'masha paniti libcha l'shol olecha. And this hechitim never occurred to me. The harich lo chichol v'ayshol alze. And he sat there and he really ranked them out as a. Did he still say that? And he really gave it to him on the head. for coming for wasting his time with what he saw were idle halachic speculation. So it's interesting. Rab Chaim, I heard in the name of the Rav that Rab Chaim Brisker thought that this statement on the part of Rabbeinu Bachya was apikorsis, which I understand from the point of view of the world of Volozhin. But in the Sephardic world here, we're learning Gemara is for Lasuke Shemayt Salibi the Hilchasa. So what you do to study to be able to develop your neshama. So you learn halacha, and then you study something else to learn to develop your neshama, to develop your ruchnius, to develop your intellect, which is the connection between you and God. So it's whether it's philosophy, whether it's Kabbalah, whatever the case might be, there's something else on the table. The size next to the Ktzos HaKoshen is also maybe the Svasemis, or in this case it'll be the Gesefer Kuzari, or whether it's the Lelat HaCharir in the Mor Nebuchadnezzar, whatever the case might be. In other words, the yeshiva curriculum as a result of this specific stance vis-a-vis the question of how do you paskin, what do you look for, and what is the nature of learning Gemara, and how do you learn Gemara, the nafkamina is precisely what do you learn also for your neshama. Okay? So far so good? Okay. Alright. This is precisely the position that was adopted by the Rambam. The Rambam, when he wrote the Mishneh Torah, first of all integrated vast sections of assumed that the study of philosophy, each person according to their capacity, was an integral part of Talmud Torah. It was not extra. It was not Limudei Chol. It was, as the Rambam writes in the introduction to the Mor Nebuchadnezzar, Talmud Torah al Ha'emet, because it's all integrated. You have to have the Masim, and you have the Divrei HaNeshama. He also paskin dois almost every single open shaila in halacha, as far as he was concerned, to allow people to have a halachic guide, and then to be able to go further. And to develop their minds at the same time, which for him was ruchnius. In a letter that he writes to one of his students, he has a student who went out of town, and I think he went to Baghdad or Damascus. At the moment, it's Barakli, exactly where. The Solomon asked him, what should I do? What should I study? He says, first of all, you should make a living as a doctor. By the way, medicine in the Middle Ages was simply applied philosophy. So if you had a regular, you went through the general, BA curriculum, you ended up getting applied philosophy, which is medicine. That's what you did for a living. So you should be a doctor. He says, as far as Talmud Torah is concerned, you should learn the Mishneh Torah. And you should be medayik in the Mishneh Torah, and you should be mefalpel in the good sense of the Mishneh Torah, ma'ayin in the Mishneh Torah. He says, if it's something you don't understand, he says, okay, here, okay, I will read it inside. Number 6, the next page. Vatzatihi shetaseh yegiacha ha-mischar, make a living from, by the way, you know the Rambam was emphatic that rabbis shouldn't take money for learning. Vatzatihi, you can go into business. The Rambam was the silent partner of his brother David. He only went into practicing medicine. His brother David, who is also apparently a tremendous Talmud Chacham, was a pearl merchant, and he drowned in the Indian Ocean on a trip to the Far East looking for jewels. Jews, in other words, not all Jews in the jewelry trade are from Belgium. In any case, the Rambam was the silent partner in the business, and it was only after his brother David died that he went into practicing medicine practically. That's the code? Be'emet. In other words, don't forget the philosophy is part of Talmud Torah. V'lo tilmad, or tilamed, ela hilchot harav. So first your point of departure should be the Rif. V'tashve oto lachibur. And you should then follow it through to the chibur. So you anchor what I say, the Rambam speaking, in the Mishneh Torah, in the Gemara, through the Rif, without all the interim Meshach Levitaria that the Rif removed. Okay? The immatata machloket, and if you see there's a machlokes between me and the Rif, Teidu, the Rambam actually says in one place that there's only 10 places where he disagrees with the Rif. It's not quite that. The question, how do you understand that statement? Because there are literally, there's a lot more than 10 places. In any event, if you find that I disagree with the Rif, or the Rif disagrees with me, Teidu she iyun ha-talmud mi bilakach, that we disagree with the interpretation of the Gemara. V'tidrashu b'mekomotav, so then you go back to the original sugya in the Gemara. The intich, but, this is the dangerous statement. The intich ha-leze mancha b'ferushim, u'b'ferushay ha-vayot ha-gemara, the otam ha-devarim asher hinachnu me'amalam, which we saved everybody from, harei ze ibud hazman u'miyut ha-to'elet. It's a waste of time. Okay? So you're all going to pack up and go back to America? No. Okay? But that was the attitude up until the 12th century in Spain. We will see that that did not stay the position in Spain because of the revolution that was wrought by the Ramban. But that we're going to save them, I think, for the next. The last year will be a week, Mitzvah Shem, a week from today, apparently at this time. Okay, but that was the position. What was wrong with this position? What was the problem with this approach? It's simple. It's one dimensional. It's two dimensional. Where do you go from there? How does halacha grow? How do you apply? Where do you get the tools to be able to apply, to rule on new things? I mean, it becomes a very static attitude towards the nature of Torah and of halacha. The way that Professor Chaim Soloveitchik put it in one place was the Rambam thought he was hewing in granite the upshot of all the statements of the Gemara. But something that's written in granite is permanent. That's it. That's all. That's what you got. So that is the classic Sephardic position up until 1150. Okay. Now we're going to move north. When we get to the Ashkenazim, it's a whole new world. It's a whole different world. It's a whole different position. It's a whole different stance, intellectually, legally, from point of view commentary, and spiritually. There are many reasons to think, okay, that the very different world that I'm going to describe to you in the rest of today's shiur is rooted in the fact that it goes back to the two different centers of Torah that existed certainly throughout the time of Bayit Sheni and maybe back to the time of Galut Bavel, or the beginning of Galut Bavel. That is the difference between Babylonia and Eretz Yisrael. There is no question that much of what distinguishes Ashkenaz and Sfarad is due to the fact that Ashkenaz is profoundly, or was profoundly, influenced by the traditions, whether they're mystical, legal, methodological, liturgical, of Eretz Yisrael. From point of view of if you can imagine a map of the Mediterranean in your head right now, so imagine like this: that Babylonia basically spread out through the Muslim world through ultimately Eretz Yisrael, Egypt, North Africa, Spain. That's all one world, and Eretz Yisrael was connected to Europe through Italy. Jews are going back and forth to Italy from the time of Chazal. We have all these stories about Tanaim that are on boats and they're going places and they're doing things and they're studying, we don't know where they're going for. Most of the time they're going to Italy. Okay? So when they go to Italy, they go for three reasons. Okay? Or four reasons. Why? I mean, what was the reason I was invited to give this year in the first place? Because the Ramim from Har Etzion were running around the United States, and they basically had a number of different things in mind that they wanted to do. One thing they did was what? Was to recruit students. Good. Number two, what else did they do while they were there? They raised money. Number three, they also taught. This is exactly what the Tanayim did when they went to Italy and when they went elsewhere. They gave shiurim, and they looked for students, And where they set up branches, for example, there was a there was a branch of the Yeshivat Eretz Yisrael in Rome that was headed up by Rabbi Matya ben Cheresh of Alti Zanav LaRayot Heye Zanav LaRayot Balte Rosh LaShoalim fame. And to raise money. Okay, good. In fact, there's a famous matseva they found in southern Italy in which a very wealthy lady was buried underneath this matseva at this kever, and it says that her it comes from the 9th century in southern Italy in Calabria, that it says that she at her funeral there were due apostoli et due rebetes, two apostles and two rebbes, two rabbis. Who are apostles? What's an apostle? So I know what today is on the calendar, but what does the word really mean? Shluchim. Remember, it's an apostle in Latin, apostolos. It's a shliach. It's a mashuluch. It's a mashuluch. This is Thursday night in southern Italy, and they're banging on the door collecting fees. She's not there. It's thrilled. They were at this lady's funeral because she was apparently a very fine. They apparently built a building for her in some place in some yeshiva in northern Eretz Yisrael. Anyway. We know there were very strong connections in Eretz Israel and Italy, and as a result, there is much reason to think that a lot of what I'm going to say now is rooted in the traditions of Eretz Israel, certainly in the time of the Yerushalmi, if not before. Okay, for our purposes, the most important thing to keep in mind is the fact that the approach to truth in Torah, in certainly among Ashkenazim and most likely among in Eretz Yisrael, okay, was very different than that of the Sephardim. Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal used to always say that Judaism does, and this is reflecting an Ashkenazi position, does not believe in end logic. End logic is the principle of the excluded middle that was developed by Aristotle, and that is that something cannot be both A and not A. Okay. The Torah doesn't accept that. You can be both A and not A. You can have complexities. You can have contradictions at the same time. It's okay. Contradictions can coexist, at least as far as our limited understanding is concerned, or maybe more. You find the following story numbers here are bad. Medrash Tehillim, Mizmor Yudbeis, and Medrash Tehillim is an Eretz Israeli medrash. In fact, most medrashim are written in Eretz Israel, not Babel. Babylonians were not heavy into Medrash. Amar Rabbi Yanai, lo nitnat divrei Torah chasichin. The Torah is not given with unilateral determinations. Ela al kol dibur shahaya omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu leMoshe, haya omer mentes panim tahor or mentes panim tameh. Every single shayla has 49 ways you can go either way. Tameh or tahor. So Moshe better gets up to heaven, and he said, what? I mean, I can't function like this. V'amar lefanav ribono shel olam, ad masay namor al beruah shel davar. How are we gonna? I can't function like that. I mean, which is it? Amarle says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, achrei rabim lahatos, rabu amitamim tamei, rabu amitarim tar. It's up to you. You're paskin this way, you're paskin that way. It's okay. Now, that's a tremendously empowering position from the point of view of Kodesh Baruch Hu, but what does it say in terms of the nature of machlokas? What does it mean in terms of what we do in terms of learning? What statement does it transform? It transforms the statement, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. It's not a matter of they both got to their where they got to, but with the proper methodology, but one of them is right and one of them is wrong. No, they're both right. They're both a chetzah shel Torah. We paskin this way, we paskin that way. But if you spend all day long learning Beis Shammai, you get as big a kiyum of Talmud Torah as you did learning Beis Hillel. And that's precisely, interestingly, and this position is consistently cited by Ashkenazi Rishonim all the way down the line. I've been able to document it from at least the 12th century. The idea is best known, ironically, quoted by a late Sephardi Rishon, the Ritzvah, Rabbi Yontav ben Avraham al-Izbili from Seville, also the place where Christopher Columbus is buried, but not really relevant. The Ritzvah in Erevin, on Dr. Gimel Amid Beis, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. Shalu rabbanei Tzorfat. But we know this is not just rabbanei Tzorfat. This goes way back before that. Hayach efshar shiyu shneim divrei Elokim chayim. Ze oser v'ze matir. V'tertzu kisha'ala Moshe l'morom l'kabel Torah heru lo'al kol dover v'dover mentis panim le'isur mentis panim le'heter v'shala kodesh baruch hu ozeh v'amar shi'ezeh masur l'chachmei Yisrael shem chol dor v'dor v'yucha achra asam kemosam v'na'i. So the reverse is, that's nice, it's a nice drush. Okay, and he's got a deeper reason, al pi Kabbalah. But that's a totally different stance. That means that every single half, it's a totally different attitude towards the Gemara. It means that every single angle, every single Havamina has significance. You can't go with this approach and reject Okimtas, because Okimtas, even if they're rejected, still have what to teach you. This transforms the, this approach transforms the definition and the nature of learning Gemara. Transforms Halacha too, by the way. All right. I said at the beginning of just now, that a few minutes ago, that Sephardim write codes that make order. Ashkenazim are the ultimate halachic anarchists. Okay, that's what they like to do. Balagan. Ashkenazim, no Ashkenazim. I'm okay, except for the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, which probably is not the best place to start your search for Pesach. Ashkenazi Gedolim from day one to day today have never written universal codes paskening ois every single kasha or shaila. Never. Why? Because there is no unilateral determination. There is minhag, which is binding. There's consensus. There's all kinds of things which force you, which determine how one should act. Think about any Rama that you can think of. All right? He says, yesh no'im kacha, yesh no'im kacha. So he'll say, we should do this and we should do that, and we've accepted that. That's the way, that's called sugi da'alma. That's the way that the consensus, the halakha consensus goes. But to say that this is the only legitimate position, no. Lehefech. What do Ashkenazim do? What is the relationship? If you open up any great poskim, whether you're talking about the Rif or the Rambam or the Tur or the Beit Yosef or the Shulchan Aruch, you name it. Where are the Ashkenazim? What do they do?
They comment.
Well, what do they do to comment? You know, I'll give you the classic example. That the Ramah, when he writes that he's going to write the commentary on the Shulchan Aruch after he'd already written the Darchei Moshe, he says, I'm going to take the Shulchan Aruch and I'm going to put a mapa. That's what it's called. His kid says, I'm putting a tablecloth on top of the Shulchan Aruch. And everybody says it's a wonderful thing he did, because that made the Shulchan Aruch accessible and the work for all of Klal Yisrael. Except maybe the same money. They still go by the Rambam. All right? But think about what he demanded to do that. The Mechaber hoped that everybody was going to accept all of his Pesach Halach and it'd be one Torah. Comes the Ramah and he undermines the ultimate goal of the Mechaber by adding the Ashkenazi. No, yes, it's good. He's adapted it so we can use the book. And yes, in those places where he doesn't disagree, we accept the Mechaber. But that's because the Ashkenazi won't agree. You follow? The acceptability of the Shulchan Aruch was attained by undermining the intent of the author. Why? Because the traditional Ashkenazi position is that there is no one truth. There is no one truth. That, an even more extreme example, I'm not going to read, do we have to read this inside? Yes. I mean, even more extreme example of this is found in the Marshal. Rav Shlomo Luria in the 16th century, a first cousin of the Ramah and a contemporary of the Mechaber, the Ramah. The 16th century was an amazing time. Unfortunately, they did not put this on the Bar Ilan Project of Shut yet, so I had to take it off of HebrewBooks.org, again, Elohim, because without it, I'd have even less room in my house. Anyway. In Akdama to Baba Kama, I actually have a Yom Shel Shlomo in the house. Anyway, this was just easier. This just easier than picking it up and trying to hold it while my scanner, with the mice that run the scanner, are very tired and they go, oh, it doesn't work. Anyway,
In this, in the Yakzamets of Baba Kama, the Marshal goes on and talks about the nature of revelation, and he says when Klal Yisrael was sitting at Har Sinai, they heard 600,000 Torahs. Now that doesn't mean the 600,000 Torahs. What he's trying to say is he's validating. He's basically taking the same position that was expressed by the Medrash and by the Ritva, and intensifying it, saying no, every. It's a mitzvah makabel, and every person has what to give, has what to add in terms of an insight to an endless Torah. It's open ended to the nth degree. What the Marshal does here is to take a theory of the Arizal. The Ari taught that every single tribe of the 12 tribes had their own derech and avodas Hashem and derech and nusach tefillah, and there were 12 different lines of revelation to each tribe. So the Marshal goes and says, no, this is every single person in the Kabbalah Torah heard it a little bit differently, and they were all legitimate. In other words, machlokas is part of the game because the Torah is multifaceted and endless. Okay, what are the implications? Now, once that's your position, what are the implications? So, in terms of ruchnius that we talked about before, there's a very strong tradition, and it's not exclusive, but a tradition among Ashkenazim from the time of the Balei Tosfos certainly on, which ends up leading all the way straight through till Reb Chaim Volozhiner, to the Gra, Reb Chaim Volozhiner, and you're sitting in this room in the tradition of Lithuanian yeshivas, that learning the Gemara is sufficient. Should provide you with everything you need in terms of not only just knowing dasa, knowing what to do halacha lemaisa, but the experience of Talmud Torah, which is an act of revelation, of standing there with the 160,000 people and finding, and each one finding their own insights to add to the conversation. I hate that word. To the ongoing discourse around Talmud Torah. It's not exclusive because you have parallel traditions among Ashkenazim. We say no, you have to learn. You can accept this way of learning Gemara and attitude towards halacha, and still learn philosophy and mysticism. Chassidim hold like that. Okay. Musar. That's number one. Number two. If your position is that every single thing that's said in the process of learning has significance and expands your understanding and is an act of Talmud Torah, an act of revelation, so therefore, by definition, you look at the Gemara as a whole. Nothing, you don't reject Okimtas because everything teaches you something. Right? And it's against that background that we begin to understand Rashi. Now, Rashi, we're going to talk about Rashi and hopefully start talking about Tosfos today. Rashi, there are some people whose achievements are such. There are very smart people. There are Gaonim, there are all kinds of people. There are some Gedolim, when you look at what they achieved, you just sit there with your mouth, with your jaw drops. Because it's not, you don't know what to do with it. Rashi was like that. The Rambam was like that. We still don't know all the sources the Rambam used. They're still trying to figure it out. Okay? If you really want to, the kind of person you want to love to hate, it's pretty clear by looking at the Parash HaMishnayos that the Rambam had worked out all of his halachic and philosophical positions by the time he was like in his early 30s. Okay. Rashi's achievement in writing, in his commentary on the Gemara is something like that. Now, up until Rashi, okay, in learning in Ashkenaz. Now, when we talk about Ashkenaz, we're talking about a very specific area. You're talking about northern France north of the Loire River. Anything south of the Loire River is another world that's Provence, and we're not going to talk about that in the Shurim. Northern France and western and central Germany, the Rhineland, There's a line of two rivers called the Elbe-Zala line that runs down the middle of Germany. That's Ashkenaz. That's the cradle of everything that later becomes Ashkenazic Jewry. And the cradle of the cradle is the Rhineland. Specifically, three cities, three communities. Actually, just two. Worms and Mainz, or Magenza. Speyer comes in later. Everything starts in those two cities. Especially in Mainz, which is the birthplace of Ashkenazic Jewry. And there was a yeshiva in Mainz, which was founded even before Rabbeinu Gershom Mor HaGola, who died in 1028. And it was the place to go if you wanted to learn. Other people learned Torah, it's not like they didn't. But if you really wanted to learn, you went there. And in the yeshiva of Mainz was developed a commentary on the Gemara which went line by line. And you memorized it and you left. And if you, the longer you stayed, the more you knew. What you didn't know, what you didn't stay for, you didn't know. The commentary was done collectively. Okay? There was a Rosh Yeshiva, but the Talmidim were very much in there and they were not deferential and they were fighting. And interestingly, all the comments that were made in all the different interpretations of various sugyas as they went through from Brachas to Nida, including Kutchim, interestingly, from Brachas to Nida, were recorded deferentially as if they were said by the Rosh Yeshiva. You can find that commentary that was collected and developed over time, which used to be called Peirushei Magenza. Today they're called Peirushei Rabbeinu Gershom Mor HaGola, but he started developing this collective effort. He did not write all of it. Okay. However, it wasn't edited, and it wasn't available to everybody. And if you didn't know it by heart, those parts of it by heart, you were stuck. Okay, there were mesechtas you wouldn't know, wouldn't be able to function. Why? For a very simple reason. Anybody, did you ever try to use, I don't know, you know, you guys have some Schottenstein, so it's like not relevant anymore. Do you ever use Sansino? Okay. So you'll be up to Sansino. You can read through a whole sugya, and the words make sense, and the sentences go together, but it doesn't really help you in learning, except to know what the hard words are. Right? It doesn't, there's something missing. What's missing? The way that the Amorayim put the Gemara together is it's written in what's called a telegraphic fashion. Meaning that all the major points are there, but there's a lot of stuff that's not there that you assume that you know. Strange words, what they mean. Background information. What's another biggie? Punctuation. Okay? Cross references. You know, when the Gemara says, Kid'isa b'zeh, so good, so I know what the zeh is. Alright? This commentary that was developed in Magenza begins to try to fill in those blanks. Sometime around in the year 1040, a young man was born in France to a family that was partly related to one of the Rosh Yeshiva in Magenza, in the town of Troyes. The rabbis in Troyes were fairly educated, but the young man, his name was Shlomo, we know him as Rashi, fairly quickly, by the time he was 18, pretty much tapped out everything that the locals had to offer him. He was already married, apparently had at least one kid, and he decided, Chashka Nafshi B'Torah, he went to move to Magenza. Now he knew that he wasn't going to have time to sit there and go Kometal of Awe and to memorize all of these Perushim. So he spent, he was back and forth a few times, his mother was widowed at that point, he still kept having kids, he had two daughters, three daughters, historically problematic a series of novels called Rashi's Daughters, forget about it. The author claims she had three daughters. He really only had two daughters. Not important. Don't. I'm telling you, if you see the books, don't read them. Very simple. Okay. And I say that not only as a direct descendant of Rashi, according to a very, very enthusiastic cousin, but also just because you should spend your time reading good things and rather than silly things. In any event, Rashi knew he wasn't going to have a lot of time to sit there and go Kamatalafar. So he spent his time, A, getting the crib notes on all of the Perushim he could get a hold of, and more importantly, to learn method. Okay? How do you go about interpreting Gemaras? How do you do it? And also information, putting together little dictionaries about with Persian words and loan words and so on, that nobody else, no other way of knowing how to read them. And he goes back to Twa when he's in his mid-20s. And he sets himself the task of casting a perush on the Gemara, which starts from Brachas and goes to Nida. Now, not every single perush that we have in the name of Rashi is Rashi, and there are a lot of some places we don't have Rashi. So, for example, we don't have Rashi on most of Baba Basra. You know the old joke that it says in Pizarro, it says that Khan made Rashi because apparently Baba Basra killed Rashi as it killed not a few other fine Lamdanim. And anyway, we know that we don't have Rashi for the end of Makkos, and there's some question about the parish at the end of on the 10th parak in Sanhedrin, and everybody knows there's a big shaila about Rashi and Nidarim and Nazir, and because the printers, when they printed up whatever they had, they took what they thought was Rashi, but just because Bomberg, who was a goy, said this was Rashi, doesn't mean this was Rashi. In fact, there's a Tosfos in Tanis, I think it's Daf Ches Amud Aleph, where Tosfos is a discussion of where Bameshi Mesh Moshe Kol Shiva, so the Tosfos ends up in the middle. In the middle of the sentence. So where's the Tosfos? Luckily, the rest of the Tosfos is found in the Rav on Tanis. So remember when we learned Tanis with the Rav, so the Rav looked up and he said, "See? What happened? Somebody took a scissors like this. They stuck it in." So he looked at us. We had a little group in on Sunday mornings of Chevra Shas. A lot of older people fell asleep, and about five or six of us who were awake and came every week. So the Rav looked up. He says, "Who are the greatest poskim in the history of Yiddishkeit?" So we're getting knockers. So and the Rav said, "You're all wrong." "Who are the greatest poskim?" He says, "The printers, the caterers, and the photographers." They determine the future of Yiddishkeit. Anyways, that was a joke. Don't say that I quoted the Rav saying that the photographers are the greatest poskim that Yiddishkeit ever, the Jewish people have developed. The printers might be. Anyways, the point is, but Rashi sat down to write down a perush on all of Shas. Now, what did he do? Okay, first of all, with a style that has never been seconded. In fact, one of the great maskilim, the atheist maskilim that I one of the greatest ones I knew as a kid growing up said, "If you need," this is a guy who enjoyed eating, chazer and yom kippur, but he said, he was a famous Hebrew poet though. He said that he was related actually to a very prominent Haredi spokesman in Yerushalayim, so I'm not going to mention any name. He used to say that if you really want to see beautiful Hebrew, the most elegant Hebrew style possible, you read Rashi or you read the Rambam. Nobody's ever gotten to that height of felicity of expression. With a style which is not too, it was absolutely inimitable, he supplied every single thing required for a person to be able to pick up a Gemara and learn. Throughout all of Shas, okay, all of Shas, background information, lexicon of difficult words, de facto punctuation. How do you know when Rashi puts in punctuation? He says what? Ditmia. It's not clear if the or benichuta. It's a statement or it's a question. He gives it punctuation. Cross references. Sometimes the cross references are explicit. Sometimes the cross references are coded in. Sometimes he'll say Kidisa Beresh Ezaperek. He won't tell you the daf why. Why does the Rashi know what the daf is? There were no dafim. The dafim were invented by a non-Jewish printer named Daniel Bomberg in Venice in the early 16th century. But he says it's the beginning of this parak, the middle of that parak, the end of that parak. Yeah, you'll find it. All right. Sometimes he codes in. Okay. So I'll give you one example. All right, that's the one I like to quote. And Daf Beis Amud Beis in Bava Metzia, the Gemara on this question on the sugya of whether Shnayim Mochzim the Metalis quotes the Gemara in Kiddushin. Okay. About a case where a guy was selling something, and two guys threw the money at the meicher, and he doesn't remember who he gave it, who he sold it to, and the two of them are hanging on to the last high definition television, and he can't remember who to tell you to. Okay, you're fair. If you look at Rashi in Kiddushin, without an explicit cross reference, Rashi codes in the words Shnayim Ochzin to his commentary. So the advanced student knows that if I want to understand this sugya, I got to conflate it with the one above Metzia and put them together, and then I'll understand. Okay. And he does this for all of Shas. He also, by the way, I recently, somebody on Facebook sent me a thing. It was very cute. Guy goes into in 11th century France. A guy goes into a bar, mumbling. He orders something and he sends it back. And he walks out, and the bartender asks the guy next to him, "What's bothering Rashi?" But Rashi does in fact entertain multiple. It's true, multiple possibilities of how to interpret a specific passage, and gently rejects them. In other words, when you ask the question, how come Rashi didn't interpret this way, it's a legitimate question, because Rashi, if you read the word, the way Rashi writes carefully, he really did. Okay? More than that, Rashi also wrote on not only a Masechtas that he had Masoris from his teachers, like the Babas, you know, the usual suspects, but on Masechtas that there was no tradition on whatsoever. Take a look at on page 3, number 8. This is a tshuva of Rashi. There's no such thing as tshuvas Rashi. There was a rabbi in Pittsburgh named Rabbi Elfenbein who put together all of the tshuvas that are found in manuscripts and other sources and called it tshuvas Rashi. Unfortunately, when he published them, the versions of the tshuvas that he quoted as the most important, most authentic ones, as one prominent scholar said, he could have taken all the manuscripts, thrown them up the stairs, and picked only the ones that fell on the first step, and he would have had a better ratio of success than what he did by doing it machshava. But all right. Anyways, this text is all right. He writes back to somebody. He says, "Halev yodea tered hamatzui bi'agor bi'yikavim." He's "I'm very busy in my vineyards, and therefore I can't write back." This is the statement which everybody quotes, that Rashi, in fact, was a winemaker, that he was a vintner. As Professor Soloveitchik points out in a couple of his articles and in one of his books, it's not possible. Oh, I mean, maybe it is possible, but the area of all the areas of France where there's no atzlacha in growing vines commercially, Troyes, where Rashi lived, is one of them. The soil doesn't support such things. It's just, it doesn't. For Soloveitchik suggests that he might have been an egg salesman for the same money. Apparently, what Rashi's talking about is very simple. In the Middle Ages, you have to know why, to be a historian, you also have to know how to learn a little bit. To this day, the area of France where Rashi lived, first of all, Jews then did not allow Gentiles to have any part of the creation of the winemaking process. Later on, there were certain kulas that Rashi himself was able to introduce by more carefully reading the Gemaras. But at the time, only Jews did the work. And you had to harvest, press, and store all of the grapes for an entire year's wine consumption, okay, in the months of September and October. Now, people, there was no coffee, there was no diet cola, I can't believe that. There was no diet soda, there was no tea, there was no nothing, there was what you drank, sometimes you had milk, but that could be deadly, and if you can't have a flachix, right? So everything they drank was wine. So wine was not just a matter of, wine was a big deal. And you had to do a whole year's worth of creation, of wine manufacturing, in 2 months. Now, what always happens in September and October? Okay, so let's do this. Let's do it this way. Erev Shabbos is relatively short. Shabbos. So you've already got, what's that, it's 16 days, no work. In addition, you have Yontif, okay? You have Yontif Sheni. Rashi happens to hold, by the way, that Malacha and Chol HaMoed is Osir Midoraisa, which means that the degree to which you have wiggle room to be able to determine Dovra Aved is significantly less. So imagine that you've got to create enough wine for an entire year in what's left. So of course Rashi has no time to sit there and write tshuvas because he's trying to make wine for the year. By the way, wine is extremely expensive as a result, kosher wine. How do I know? Now, if I were to come into your house and say, I'm going to give you, if you invite me to dinner, and I brought you a box of neon bulbs, would you say that was like a really nice house gift? Say, well, you pay $4 a bulb, you brought 3 bulbs, what's the big deal? Okay? Shabbos morning. What does every Ashkenazi kehillah in the world bless somebody for? People who bring Ner Lema'or B'yayin L'Kiddush L'Havdalah. That's a distinguished, that's a very nice donation to the show. Why Ner Lema'or? Well, you tell me, anybody who's from, anybody from the New York area? Okay, anybody from Boston area? Okay, the New Yorkers, you've ever been to Old Bethpage? Okay, you ever been to Old Cribbage Village, Mr. Bostonians? How do you make candles? You take a stick and you put wicks and you stand there like this, like a garland for 5 years. Okay? Candles are profoundly expensive because they're labor intensive. Okay? Now, Rashi made wine for his own person. Like my brother used to make raisin wine for Pesach, so same thing over here. Me Daniel, so he had a shaila here by with regards to, the shaila over here was like this. When a tipas cholov falls onto a piece of meat, okay, does the milk acid the chasichas basar the no same time or b'mashehu? That's the shaila. In other words, you need to have enough milk to be no same time in the chasichas basar to be able to acid to basar the cholov or no, okay. There were some disparities between the parallel sugyas in Avodah Zarah and Chulin on this issue. We paskin straight stuff that in order for the chasicha to become also, you need to have the tipas cholov has got to be nosed. So has to have enough to be nosing time in the chasicha. Now look at Rashi quotes on this issue. Mihidani alai shamayim va'aretz shekibalti mirabeno Yitzchak Halevi b'shchitas Chulin, when they learned Chulin together, this was his Rebbe, shebechol then it clearly says that the cholov has to be no same time in the chasicha. We don't learn from Chulin. We don't accept that opinion. Because if you look at Basa and Avodah Zarah, it says that no, even a mashu of cholov on the basa passes the chasicha. And Rashi adds, "Vani lo nasati libi az lachkor b'dvarim." I didn't pay attention. I didn't really check it out at the time. I took his word for it. The halo rabbeinu lo hayashone masechet avodah zarah. Now it's very strange to believe, to understand. In fact, he didn't even have a masechet avodah zarah. Now it's unbelievable in a world which is it's like Christmas every day. Okay, as long as we mention a contemporary reference, all the dinim. How do you deal with a Christian society which is forcing itself in, and you don't have masechet avodah zarah in front of you? Okay? Alright? So, but Rashi writes a parish on Avodah Zarah. So, he didn't have it, so clearly he didn't have a masoret on Avodah Zarah as to how to interpret it. They didn't learn it in Magensa because they didn't have it. Yet Rashi wrote a parish on Avodah Zarah. And you know what? If you compare it to Bab Metzia, you can't tell the difference. Rashi interprets it with the same precision, elegance, intensity, and sophistication as he does Bava Metzia that everybody learned. The end result was, and this will close today, I guess, the end result was that in contrast to Rabbeinu Hananel, who assumed apparently that the only people who are going to learn Gemara are going to be Talmidei Chachamim or in Yeshiva, for whom most things are Devarim Pshutim, Rashi created a perush which liberated, democratized the Gemara, so that anyone with any kind of just basic education could open up a Shas and learn. And it has more levels of understanding than I mean, new dimensions are always revealed. So for the beginner, he has comments like "Begemari yefemefarishla." Don't worry, keep going. You'll find out what the answer is. For the advanced students, he has the coded in cross references, or the slightly, you know, sort of like deflected interpretations. Okay, what Rashi's Perush did was, A, democratize learning so that everybody could learn. You didn't have to go and just memorize what they said in Magensa. I mean, it's a good thing to get advanced study. Okay, that's number one. Number two, for the first time since Ravina or Ravashi, you didn't just go page after page of Gemara. You could actually look at the whole thing. Because you didn't have to sit in Magensa and memorize from Brachas to Nida and come out, you're 85 years old, it's too late to do anything else. Now you can open up, if you know there's a sugya here and a sugya there, and you can compare them, because you always have Rashi here and you have Rashi there, you're all set. So the Gemara now is available as a whole. Okay? And every line is pregnant with meaning. Nothing should be skipped, because, as we saw, everything is resonant, everything is significant. It's called omni-significance. Okay? Now that set the stage for Tosfos, which was a revolution. We'll talk about next time. In addition, the fact that what Rashi did also, by making all of the Gemara available, it never had to be done again. No one has ever felt the need, certainly not equaled, Rashi's achievement. You'll tell me Steinsaltzen, Schottenstein, and this and that. If you look at Schottenstein, if you look at all the knockoffs, you know, the Halacha Brura and the Halacha this and this and that and the other thing, basically when they do this interlinear thing, you know, the big black words, and then they put the stuff in the middle, it's only copying Rashi. Interestingly, Rashi worked a revolution not just in Ashkenazic circles. Because up until the time of the Rambam, people learned, when they learned Gemara straight, they learned with Rabbeinu Hananel. Once Rashi's Perush began to spread, Rabbeinu Hananel was consigned to the dustbin of the Genizas. We only now, in the 21st century, are beginning to have the full Perush of Rabbeinu Hananel. Because once Rashi's Perush came, can't compete. But there's a statement in Rashi's Perush. Every line is pregnant with meaning. Every line is important. The Gemara is an integrated whole, and as a result, you go line by line, and you experience and internalize an encounter with the ongoing tradition of Torah Shebal Peh in the dialogues and monologues and discussions that the Bavli contains. Adkan for today.